Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome. You're listening to Republic Broadcasting at republicbroadcasting.org. Today is Friday, October 6th, 2023. I'm your host, Richard Carey, and this is Beyond the Official Narrative. And I have a full panel with me today, folks, for an excellent roundtable discussion. A couple are RBN hosts here. Perhaps some of you aren't familiar with everyone. We have Travis here with us. He's doing a show late Friday nights. That's 10 p.m. to 12 a.m. Central on every Friday night. Final Hour with Travis. And we became familiar with him from fellow friend, another host at the station, William Repillum, a good friend of mine. Travis, thanks for being here. This is your second time on my roundtable. Good to have you.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Appreciate it, Richard.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And then we have Keith Preston back with us, folks. For those of you who missed my previous shows with Keith, Keith is a managing editor at attackthesystem.com, an analyst at Press TV, author at Black House Publishing, an online podcast host, and a former instructor of sociology. Keith's also been on a roundtable panel just last week. Keith, good to have you here today.
Good to be back on the program, as always.
Thank you, sir. Likewise. And today, as another special treat, we have another RBN host who made some time available, folks. If you don't, you should catch the broadcast that follows mine, 1 p.m. Central, here on RBN Monday through Friday. National Bugle Radio with Patrick Slattery. Patrick, thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me, Richard.
Indeed, Patrick. Yes, I mean, you were, you know, very warm and inviting to me ever since early on when I was on this station. And I certainly didn't forget that. I helped out on your show at one point. We became closer ever since, collaborating. It seems like we have a lot of mutual friends at this point as well.
Yeah, and we've hung out together.
Yeah, yeah, yes, yeah, in person.
In person.
So we vetted out the Fed concerns. I love those.
Okay, so what are we talking about today?
No, you know, I would like you gentlemen to get a bit better acquainted, and I have some articles we could bounce off you gentlemen as well. But I don't know. Maybe we could start with just I don't know. You know, getting acquainted between you and Keith. So, I mean, well, yeah, Keith has been a correspondent with Press TV for quite a lot of years. I've heard your commentaries on there, Keith. So, yeah, I mean, geopolitics is something Patrick is also very interested in, and political science. I don't know. So taking it from there, I don't know, Patrick, what might you ask Keith about?
Yeah. Hey, what the heck is sociology anyway?
Well, that's a really good question. A lot of sociologists differ among themselves on that. But the technical definition is that sociology is one of the branches of the social sciences. In the sciences, you have the natural sciences, or sometimes they're just called the hard sciences. And that's things like biology and chemistry and zoology and physics and all of that. But then you also have the social sciences, and then that's sort of an umbrella term for sociology, as well as psychology, political science, economics, anthropology. There's a number of others, and depending on how broad you want the definition to be, you could come up with a long list of disciplines that are technically social sciences. But most sociologists, if they had to break it down to, say, a simple statement, they'd probably say sociology is the study of human behavior in groups, as opposed to psychology, which is the study of individual human behavior.
Sounds good to me.
And I think I mentioned to you, Patrick, that, I mean, well, I've known of Keith ever since, well, like, I think that Red Ice interview was like 2015. Ever since 2016, when I was doing radio, you know, I've had Keith on every so often as a guest for an interview. But Keith, you've always had a viewpoint, since I've known you, of being anti-government in general. I mean, what I've heard described as a classical anarchist, you know, because, I mean, otherwise people think of Antifa or something like that, right?
Yeah. I do self-identify as an anarchist. I identify with, you know, the historic traditions that are associated with anarchism as a collection of different philosophies. There was an excellent book that came out a few years ago called Demanding the Impossible by a British philosopher named Peter Marshall, who talked about the history of anarchist movements and philosophies and ideologies and the prototypes for these. They go all the way back to antiquity. And anarchism, you know, is distinctive in the sense that it tends to be very critical of, first of all, the state as an institutional apparatus, and by extension, you know, ruling classes, power elites, empires, things of that nature. You mentioned the relationship between Antifa and anarchists. Whenever I'm asked about that, I always say, well, we could draw an analogy to the church. You know, when people think of the church, you can think of all kinds of things. You can think of this very sophisticated philosophical apparatus that was created by figures like Augustine and Aquinas, or the patristic church fathers, or, you know, all of these theologians throughout history. Or you can think about all of these different, you know, interesting movements that have existed within you know, the history of Christianity, like everything from Gnosticism to the Brethren of the Free Spirit, to, you know, you're talking about a huge multiplicity of traditions. But then when you think of Christianity or the church, you can also think of snake handlers and really strange cults and things like that. And that's kind of how I view the Antifa. I mean, they're like not all Antifa identify as anarchists, but a lot of the Antifa anarchists, I consider them to be the snake handlers of anarchism, you know, sort of like the lowbrow, lowest common denominator kind of cultic framework.
Patrick, how would you follow that up?
Yeah, the Antifa, I used to go to anti-Iraq war demonstrations and whatnot, and you had these people who dress in black, and they describe themselves as anarchists. I didn't hear the term Antifa until, what, seven, eight years, I guess, until around the Donald Trump 2016 campaign. Maybe that's when or when Richard Spencer was making his tours or whatever. And so you'd see these people dressed in black, and they'd start dumpster fires or push dumpsters out into the street or something. And I guess I first became aware of them a few years earlier. In 1999 in Seattle, there were these anti-WTO demonstrations. Because was 1999, was that the year that the GATT was transformed into the World Trade Organization? It was sometime in the 90s. But there was the anarchists, people who described themselves as anarchists and dressed in black, rioted in Seattle when they were having one of these early meetings. Maybe it was it had to do with the World Trade Organization. So yeah. That's what when I became aware of them. And early on, 20 years ago, while I didn't endorse their message or their tactics necessarily, they were anti-war and anti-globalization. Now the Antifa now, they stylistically seem similar. They're somewhat more violent, but stylistically they seem similar. They dress the same way, but their issues are completely different. They don't care about the war. They don't seem to care about globalism. They seem to be agents of the neocons, agents of the globalists. And, you know, obviously there's this Jewish connection there, the Antifa, the term Antifa and their flag symbol really dates back to some sort of Jewish anti-fascist league from the 1930s or late 20s.
Yeah, isn't it linked to Bolshevism in Germany? The group there, it seems like a mirror of today, right, Patrick?
Yeah. Yeah, there's some sort of connection. Other people might know more about it than I do.
Travis.
I can respond to that if you wish.
Please, Keith. Sure.
A distinction needs to be made between the Antifa and the Black Bloc. The group that was being discussed, or the groups that were involved in the anti-globalization protest in the late 90s and early 2000s that were anarchists and wore these black costumes or uniforms or whatever, that's the Black Bloc, which is not the same thing as Antifa. Now, Antifa was really just getting started in the United States during that time, and it's something that's grown on the left since then, and it's absorbed some left-wing anarchists, although Antifa is not specifically anarchist. You have some Antifa identify as anarchists, others are communists. You know, I've even heard some Antifa claim they have conservatives in their movement, and by conservatives, they mean these pro-Zionist, you know, right-wing anti-fascist types, you know, like people who would watch PragerU and think that that's, you know, enlightened political commentary or something. So it's Antifa is a diverse movement, but it's not specifically anarchist, even if it has anarchists in it. But Antifa started to develop in the 2000s, and then it spiraled in the 2010s around the era of Donald Trump coming to influence. But Antifa has its roots in earlier groups that existed in the 80s and 90s. Like it has its roots in a group called Anti-Racist Action, and another one was the Sharp Skinheads, which were you had the white power skinheads or the National Socialist skinheads, and then you had these groups called SHARP that were skinheads against racial prejudice, I believe is what they were called. But so you had these kind of left or at least anti white nationalist skinheads that existed in the 80s and 90s, and then you also had some leftist subcultural groups like Anti-Racist Action that emerged during the same time, and they used to get into a lot of fights with the white power skinheads from that generation. And then some of that can be traced back to the 70s. You have in Britain in the 70s, you had the skinhead movement and the punk rock movement and all of that kind of stuff. And then some of that was fractured off into left wing and right wing factions and white power factions and anti white power factions and all of that. The modern Antifa tried to trace their roots back to the interwar period in Germany, the Weimar era, and they certainly appropriated some of the symbols of that time period. I don't think they really have their roots in that directly. It's just more of an appropriation. I mean, the roots of this go back to the punk rock and skinhead subcultures of the 70s and 80s and 90s. And then they've gone back and dug up some of this old anti-fascist stuff from the interwar period. And they'll use some of the same flags and symbolism and all that. But a common flag that's used by the Antifa is the flag of Anti-Fascist Action, which was a communist organization in Weimar Germany. It was aligned with the Red Front, which was like a communist paramilitary group, sort of a counterpart to the SA and the SS, or the S. I guess it would have been the SA at the time. And also some of them try to claim that they have their roots in the left wing side of the Spanish Civil War as well, which was a coalition of communists, socialists, anarchists, and some other groups against the Francista movement and against the Falange and some of that. So that's the general backstory to this. So the Antifa are not anarchists per se. Some of them also identify as anarchists, some don't. and the cultural roots of this, like I said, they go back to these subcultures in England and America in the late 20th century.
Wow, that's a fascinating set of information, you know, backstory. Travis.
Well, I think you guys all bring up very valid, interesting points. I didn't know the complete backstory into Antifa. But, you know, my view of things right now is it seems like society itself has kind of committed a menticide. You know, the slavery begins in the mind, basically. And there's been a systematic and intentional undermining of people's or these little groups of people's conscious minds. And I think they're acting out against their own best interests, and they don't even know it. And, you know, I guess the side would be brainwashing. So these people led it, said himself to lead it ourselves. And so I just think the power dividing and grouping us into these groups and playing us against each other, and they're masters. And I think symptoms of it.
Your sound seems to be fading in and out a lot. If you could relocate slightly to a better reception, it would help a lot. It was pretty bad there. But well, from what we picked up, Patrick, what would you like to add at this point?
Well, I would like to take advantage of our guest who's knows so much about these subcultures. So in the 1970s, I was talking, I guess, a couple of months ago to Mark Collett, and we were talking about the Sex Pistols and their lead singer, Johnny Lydon, who was in the news for some reason. And I remember in the 1970s, I could actually play all the Sex Pistols songs. I even knew the lyrics, but I didn't understand them. And I wanted to know... Well, so I guess you mentioned kind of the punk rock scene in like Orange County and Huntington Beach or whatever it's called, the skinhead movement. How about the Sex Pistols? What was their political significance in Britain? And then the Dead Kennedys was a big band, and I know they came out of California. And I actually spoke to their lead singer once years ago. And he was Jello Biafra. I think he wound up running for mayor of San Francisco as a Green or something. What was the political significance and impact of those parts of the punk rock movement, if you're familiar?
Yeah, well, when punk came along in the 70s as a subculture, you know, as a youth subculture with its own music and fashion and that kind of stuff, the Sex Pistols were not really a political group. They were a marketing gimmick. There was a guy named Malcolm McLaren who was just a sort of a huckster type of character. And he promoted, he created this band that was really just about trying to be as offensive as possible so that, you know, they could draw attention and basically make money. You know, that's what the Sex Pistols were. They were a business venture that was sponsored by this guy, Malcolm McLaren. They weren't really a political group. I mean, they had a quasi-political dimension because, you know, they would insult the Queen and talk about anarchy and all that. But, you know, that was really just about transgressiveness. But in the punk subculture, you know, the punk subculture of the late 70s was kind of like the hippie subculture of the late 60s, and that, you know, stylistically and aesthetically it was different. But there was also a political element to certain parts of it, but it had different political currents within it. You know, you had some punk rock or related tendencies that ended up, if they became political, they became more right wing. Some became more left wing. Then you develop, you know, all that stuff started coming to the United States, and you started to develop this left wing punk rock subculture in the United States, and the Dead Kennedys were a representation of that. They were from the Bay Area, and they were like a leftist punk tendency. But you also had right leaning punk or you know, other similar musical styles like hardcore. You had right wing punk, or you know, maybe kind of conservative punk and things like that. I mean, in the 80s, I knew a lot of people in these different subcultures, and their politics were all over the place. You know, you had white power punk and skinheads. You had anti-racist skinheads. You know, you had conservative punk. You had patriotic punk. You had leftist punk. You had anarchist punk, and you had communist punk. You're talking really about a cultural movement that tends to have all these subcurrents within it. You know, and as a sociologist, I can have a field day analyzing and examining all of this stuff. You know, particularly since I'm old enough that I actually remember it from when it was contemporary. But yeah, I actually met Jello Biafra once myself. That was probably about 35 years ago. But it's interesting though, because over time he's become more and more like a mainstream liberal. You know, I mean, he's practically an MSNBCer nowadays, and that's happened to so many people on the left that once had this kind of edgy framework they were operating in, that, you know, they've all just become, you know, establishmentarians.
Mm-hmm. Patrick?
When I met, it was about 35 years ago, and he had just had his band destroyed by Tipper Gore. Tipper Gore and was it Dick Cheney's wife?
Al Gore's wife
and a couple of other congressional wives or senatorial wives had gotten together, and they pushed their husbands to have congressional hearings and this and that. And it destroyed the Dead Kennedys as a band because of, I guess, lawfare, basically. They couldn't fight it. And so he was going on a spoken word tour. He didn't have a band. He was going on a spoken word tour, I guess trying to raise money for his legal fees and whatnot. And I had a friend who I used to be in a punk rock band with years earlier, and he was opening for them. His new band was opening for them. So I talked to him, and he was, you know, vaguely political, but really not particularly radical. When I think of the songs from his biggest album, one was California Uber Alles, and it was basically, I think, comparing Jerry Brown to Hitler. It's just kind of funny thinking back on it, Jerry Brown as Hitler. But yeah, I'm just bringing this up. MS, and then he got involved in politics, and in for a while at least, the Green Party in San Francisco was the one of the two big parties. The Republicans didn't really exist. So I don't know. I'm just throwing that stuff out there. I'm reminiscing.
Cool. Hey, Travis, did you want to add something at this point?
Yeah. Hopefully my audio is a little better now. I'm just kind of curious what you guys' thoughts on the whole countercultural movement, how a lot of David McGowan's writings about how these celebrities, the stars all kind of gravitated from the Arlington, Virginia area, from military industrial families, and went to Laurel Canyon and started up the whole counterculture scene. And again, I was kind of referring to earlier, just the slavery begins in the mind. And these people seem to follow these pretty self-destructive movements. And so there's a lot of evidence that says the counterculture was kind of started to, you know, co-opt and subvert a huge portion of the U.S. population. So I was just wondering if you kind of seen that pattern extended into the whole anarchist movement.
Before he answers that, you mentioned Arlington, Virginia. Wasn't Jim Morrison from Arlington? Wasn't his father an admiral or something? Tipper Gore. Tipper Gore was from Arlington. She grew up in Arlington, and Al Gore grew up in Arlington too, but he pretends he's from Tennessee.
Yeah, I'm from Richmond, Virginia, which is about 2 hours, hour and a half south of Arlington. It's practically in my backyard. Yeah, that area, the metro D.C. area, which includes northern Virginia and then southeastern Maryland, Montgomery County in that area, that is the wealthiest area of the United States. And for obvious reason, because it's where it's D.C. connected. Yeah. And my alma mater, the college that I went to is located here in Richmond. It's called Virginia Commonwealth University, which is a large public state university. And for decades, I've known lots of people from the Arlington and Northern Virginia, Fairfax and Loudoun County and all of that area. And what you have up in that area are a lot of rich kids and a lot of, you know, very affluent kids that they'll come here to the university to study art. There's a huge art school here. The art school is named after Jackson Pollock, the modern artist, who was actually funded by the CIA or promoted by the CIA. But the question that was raised, though, about the counterculture and its connections to the state, that's interesting because if you look up an organization called the Congress for Cultural Freedom, the Congress for Cultural Freedom was an organization founded back in the 1950s, and ostensibly it was supposed to be a left-wing anti-communist organization, meaning it was supposed to be an organization for people who were on the left politically, but they opposed the Soviet Union and Maoist China and international communism. And you had a lot of very prominent intellectuals associated with this, including people who later became leading neocons. For example, Irving Kristol was once the director of the Congress for Cultural Freedom, and he was one of the founding fathers of the neocon movement. And you also had, you know, I believe Gloria Steinem, who was, you know, the godmother of modern American feminism. She was associated with them at one point. In fact, I think she was employed directly by the CIA at one point. So you have this really bizarre connection between a lot of prominent left-wing intellectuals and cultural figures from the 50s and 60s and 70s and the intelligence services on the other hand. And the Congress for Cultural Freedom is one of the connecting points there. You also had figures like you had Herbert Marcuse and some of the other figures from the Frankfurt School, which was the Frankfurt School was a German think tank. It was a leftist think tank that was started in Germany in the interwar period and then came to America when the Third Reich came to power. But you had a number of prominent intellectuals associated with the Frankfurt School, like Herbert Marcuse, Theodor Adorno, Max Horkheimer, some of these other figures. And they, were, of course, were some of the intellectual godfathers of the New Left and the counterculture and that kind of stuff in the 60s. And then you also see the drug culture. The LSD, for example, was developed by the CIA as a potential truth serum. They thought they could turn this into some kind of truth serum drug. So you have this really strange connection that emerges between these ostensibly radical, ostensibly anti-establishment movements in the 60s and 70s. But if you go back and you trace their origins, you see a lot of their leading figures had connections to the intelligence services, to the CIA, to the Congress.
Absolutely. Well, that's the bottom of the hour break, folks. Stick around. We'll be right back. Second half of the roundtable.
A ship is sent to the length of his way. Just a shiver with a mouse to the ground. The ground was just a shout for the language of fear. Dreams are a mission they found to live.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Do you begin to smell some funky little things going on? Let me share this story with you. It's not so much a story, it's something I wrote years ago. Read your history, people. Stock markets collapse on Friday. Bank seizures, closures, holidays take place after business hours on Friday. Do currencies or governments also collapse on Friday? Tomorrow's Friday. Will the end come on this Friday, or will the inevitable collapse hold off for a while? The next round of the worst financial crisis in 100 years is coming, people, and the government is out to make you and I pay for it. And will your savings survive a global banking wipeout? What happens when the U.S. sees hyperinflation? What if taxes soar not only for the rich? Can you survive if the stock market tanks? Look, between a stock market wipeout, waves of bank failures, soaring government spending that will lead to hyperinflation, and the destruction of the dollar's value, isn't it time that you prepare for the uncertainty which lies ahead? Protect your money now or forever kiss it goodbye. My friends, I offer you over six decades' experience of hard asset ownership and knowledge, and I'm prepared to handle the smallest detail in the balanced protection of your portfolio. For as the future of uncertainty continues to blanket this nation of ours, I believe that I can offer you the privacy, safety, security, and possibly some profitability which you deserve. And so I invite you to visit SierraMadrePreciousMetals.com for further information regarding protecting your wealth. Or call me, Jeffrey Bennett, at 602-799-8214. Or by email at KettleMoraineLTD@Cox.net for a private consultation. Once again, our phone number, 602-799-8214. It's almost Friday.
Here's some interesting news. Due to all the recent claims about possible nuclear wars, viruses, solar flares, and civil unrest, people are scrambling to prepare and stockpile food. But the one thing out of reach for many is an underground bunker. Until now. Because you can now have a 3D printed underground bunker in just one day. An excavator digs a hole in your backyard, and 3DBunkers.com shows up in a small truck and sets up their 3D printer under a tent completely undetected. They can print as many rooms as you want at a fraction of the cost compared to traditional metal bunkers. 3D Bunkers uses polymer concrete, which is five times stronger than regular cement. YouTube 3DBunkers.com and watch the video. The creators of 3D Bunkers is looking for a business partner that can help bring this technology to the world. And we need to protect our way of life without living in fear. Contact Brad at 3DBunkers.com for more details or visit 3DBunkers.com.
Back, folks, beyond the official narrative here on Republic Broadcasting. Richard Carey with my roundtable panelists, RBN host Travis, RBN host Patrick Slattery, and my guest today, Keith Preston. And of course, if you want to check out Keith's website, Keith is at attackthesystem.com, attackthesystem.com. You can check out more of what he does. Well, I don't know. I would perhaps kick it to Travis next after Keith's comments in the last segment.
Well, Keith, I'm curious your take on, you know, the modern form of slave speak we seem to all use, at least the average person out there, and the effect of this sociology where they seem to have really group people into boxes, almost like kill boxes, and kind of put people in these camps of, you know, different thought trains. And again, I think they're playing these different camps off of each other. But I just wanted to see what your take is on, you know, the language and how it seems like we are almost enslaved by the language we use, like we're speaking slave speak in a way.
Could you be more specific? I'm not sure I quite understand your question.
Well, it just seems to me that, you know, we between money and law, it seems like that's one of the main ways they're able to control us. And it also, it appears that the way we use the language and also the way that they've able to, you know, pinpoint certain personality types, and it's almost like the corporations promote the sociopaths up to the management positions. Because they know the sociopaths will, you know, axe anybody they ask them to, or, you know, just do as they're asked, basically. So it just seems like, you know, the powers that be have mastered all these different aspects, you know, sociology, money, law, language, and they're using it against us. I guess that's my point I wanted to make. Maybe it's a question you want to add on. Or...
Well, it's, yeah, the system, institutions have a means of screening out people who are not going to be cooperative. You know, the kind of person who rises high in institutions is frequently somebody who is first and foremost a brown noser, somebody who goes along to get along, someone who, you know, is subservient to those above them, someone that doesn't question authority, someone who is going to be a team player as they want you to play, not somebody who's going to be a maverick or a whistleblower or something like that. And people who are the personality types that are not going to be just go along to get along, they have a way of screening those kinds of people out. And of course, you know, sociopathic, you know, conniving people are naturally going to be the ones for whom positions of power and influence come the easiest, because they're the ones that are going to do what they need to do to get into that position. That's one of the, you know, most serious sociological problems that human beings have, is that how do you prevent the sociopath class from gaining power? It's something that is a problem in all societies. And in terms of where we are today with some of this kind of stuff, you know, mentioning the issue of language, of course, we've all noticed that the politically correct or woke or whatever we want to call them crowd is really big on trying to police language. And there's actually a theory behind that. It was developed in the 1960s by the French postmodernist thinkers, who argued that language is power, because language shapes discourse, and then the discourse shapes the dominant narrative in a particular society, which in turn shapes the, you know, what the Marxists call the ideological superstructure, or just the dominant set of ideas that shape institutions and policies and things like that. So along the way, you had a lot of the authoritarian left decided that they really needed to control language in order to control discourse, in order to assert a narrative that can become dominant and come to control institutions. And we see that all over the place in the academic world today, particularly in certain disciplines. And increasingly, we see this in many other institutions, you know, in what I call the ideas industries, that is, institutions that deal in ideas, you know, whether it's law, whether it's academia, whether it's the media, whether it's journalism, even things like marketing, you know, human resources. We find this kind of stuff in the medical world nowadays, you know, in the professions, you know, everywhere. And what it is an effort to control language and control speech and discourse through the control of language. I mean, it's similar to what you find in older societies where, say, in the Middle Ages, you had the church that would have its index of prohibited books and, you know, blasphemy laws and heresy trials and things like that. Or in modern totalitarian states in the 20th century, you had some things that were similar. But now it's interesting that we have these sophisticated high-tech societies where the means of control are in many ways more subtle and less readily apparent, but also more effective in many ways. You know, like nowadays, you know, now that social media has become the public square, the modern equivalent of the public square, well, even if they don't arrest you for expressing a disapproved opinion, they can just simply throw you out of the public square through text censorship, or they can kill you, if not physically, they can kill you economically by getting you fired from your job or, you know, not able to open a bank account or not able to use Airbnb or, you know, all these different kinds of services. So they have these more sophisticated methods of control. You know, we see that in China with the social credit system. You know, that's another similar system as well. Yeah, so it really is interesting how these tools of manipulation, these tools of social control, have become far more pervasive and sophisticated in modern culture. Yeah, it's interesting to go back and look at some of the founders of the public relations industry, like Edward Bernays, for example. He's a famous example, but Edward Bernays was really the founder of public relations as a practice. He was an early 20th century figure who really was a specialist in propaganda and was influential in developing modern systems of public relations, advertising, propaganda, things like that, you know, which is a very sophisticated type of propaganda model. You know, it's not like the, you know, like a lot of people, when they think about propaganda, they think, again, like the 20th century totalitarian systems, you know, where they're just telling flagrant lies that are so crazy nobody is going to believe them. Whereas, you know, modern systems of propaganda, they will often throw in a lot of half-truths and blend them with things that, you know, they'll throw in a lot of things that are absurd as well. But then the goal is to bury you so deep in BS that you can't dig your way out.
Yes, I've heard it described to flood the system with so much misinformation. You're overwhelmed to know what to choose from. I'll add, with the technology, they don't even want you to own your own data. They want all of your data files stored in the cloud if they can coax you into that more and more now, you know, not just your software, but your files. And of course, you know, anyone who refers to information with online encyclopedias or historical reference sources, it's so much easier to Orwellize, if you will, the history every so often as needed. When you just have to update files and online links in the code rather than, you know, trying to remove physical books or something of that nature, Keith. We'd like to turn to Patrick.
Yeah, yeah. So,
Patrick, by the way, we have a message in the control room asking you a question as well. If you could also take care of that, but go ahead.
Okay. So early on, in the show, Keith, in explaining sociology, said, you know, it's a study of groups as opposed to the individuals. And, you know, people look around today and there's this very obvious Jewish role in what's going on. And I think people are very used to thinking in terms of, you know, individuals moving histories and tend to not think about group dynamics. And so, and when people see all of this, these destructive policies, I think there is a tendency. I hear this over and over and over again. Well, it's not all Jews. It's you know, they're just the Zionists, or it's just this subset. It's just the elite. It's just these people at the top, and they have evil intent. They're just evil, and you know, I look at it. And I do think there's this group dynamic within the Jews. There's a group dynamic which has to do with a paranoia that is nurtured and perpetuated by aspects of their religion, of their culture, of the more recently the Holocaust narrative, all of this. And there's this paranoia, and there's a group dynamic going on that that really encompasses the entire group. And it doesn't mean they're motivated by evil, and it doesn't mean everybody's evil. But, you know, one of the obstacles that we run up against is we've got this taboo. You can't talk about Jewish power. And if there is a Jew in the room, Mr. Shapiro from the next cubicle, you're not going to say anything. You know, you can't say anything about Jews. Now, if there's a black guy, can complain about whites in front of white people. There's no taboo on that. But so to me, the group behavior of Jews is really key in understanding what's going on. And rather than ascribing evil intentions to a small group of people that somehow has the ability to you know, buy off all the white politicians and whatnot. To me, there's this bigger, this broader group dynamic. And I was wondering what Keith thinks about that.
Well, I could really delve into that in some detail because there's a lot of really interesting history behind that, including history that that's not often widely discussed. Going all the way back to the early modern period, We're talking about the time of the Protestant Reformation, or perhaps maybe the English Revolution, the rise of the market revolution in European culture. You know, as Europe was evolving out of feudalism and into modern systems like mercantilism and capitalism, and then industrialization and all of that. What we see politically in a number of countries and in a variety of cultures is we see the rise of a middle class that is rooted in the merchant culture that is starting to supplant the traditional elite. Of course, the traditional elite in European societies were the royalty, the Catholic Church, and the aristocracy, the hereditary aristocracy. So you start to see the merchant class, or the what today we would call the business class, or the capitalist class, or as the socialists call it. You start to see the rise of this particular class, and that becomes increasingly dominant. That class becomes increasingly dominant. But then when you look at the rise of the merchant class, and you look at the demographic breakdown of the merchant class, what you see is that when it comes to religion and ethnicity, the early capitalism is basically an alliance of Protestantism on one hand and Judaism on the other hand, against traditional Catholicism and against the traditional elites, the traditional hereditary European elites. And then as the capitalist class becomes the dominant class, it starts to replace these older elites. And this happened, primarily and historically Protestant countries, at least initially, England, America, Holland, Germany, some of these places. France was kind of an outlier. You start to see the hegemony of the merchant class. And then culturally, you start to see this blending of Protestantism and Judaism, and nowhere is that more pronounced than in America. Because if you go back and you look at who the American founding fathers were and what kind of economic interests they represented, I'm not making a case for or against the U.S. founding fathers for purposes of this discussion, but what you see is that if you look at how the kind of system they created, they eliminated the monarchy, they eliminated the established church, they eliminated the hereditary aristocracy, they created a ruling class that a system of the ruling class was going to be the, on one hand, the northeastern merchant class, on the other hand, the southern planter class, which would have been the equivalent of the middle class or the upper middle class in a traditional European society. And then if you look at the religious background, they're mostly Protestants, and some Catholics, and also the status of Jews rises in a way that you didn't see in traditional European societies as well. And you always had influential Jews in both the North and the South in traditional American history. You had Jewish officials in the Confederate government during the Civil War, even. So America's always had this odd Protestant Jewish merchant culture hybrid as its really its dominant culture. And even when you look at the American civil religion, like back in the 1960s, there was a sociologist of religion named Robert Bella who developed this idea he called the American civil religion. And he basically went back and reviewed the speeches of presidents and prominent American political figures, Lincoln, and as well as the writings of the founding fathers and their influences. And what he determined is that in traditional American culture, while America is historically a majority Protestant culture, you also have this civic religion that is, includes elements of Protestantism. It reflects this kind of Puritan heritage. It also has elements of deism, with John Locke and Enlightenment rationalism and Thomas Jefferson and all of that. And it also has this very Old Testament Judaic influence about, the promised land, America is God's country and that kind of thing. So in American culture, you see this strange hybrid of Protestant, Jewish, and Enlightenment rationalist influences. And then what happens over time is that creates the soil, the cultural fertile ground, where ideas from Europe are increasingly imported into the United States, and they take root in American culture, and they really grow exponentially in an American cultural context because of this pre-existing cultural fertile ground. You know, so you start to see, you know, the idea of the public administration state is imported from Germany. That really starts to grow in America during the Progressive Era. That's how we get our so-called big government today. You know, you start to see the influence of Judaism as you get more and more Jewish migrants from Eastern Europe coming to the United States. That you start to see a larger Jewish presence in institutions and the cultural milieu and things like that. Also, you see other movements that are imported from Europe into the United States that really grow and expand once they get here. Their influence grows. The Frankfurt School is one of those. The leaders of the Frankfurt School were almost overwhelmingly Jewish, I mean, almost to a person. And that's where we are today. We have this, you know, I don't think that the Jewish influence would have been possible without this pre-existing Protestant Puritan influence that was, you know, came out of English Puritan culture, and without this wider Protestant Pietism that has all its way, that has its roots in German Lutheran Pietism going all the way back to the early modern era, the 1500s, 1600s. But what I'm saying though is that having all of these different cultural elements thrown into the same blender produces exactly what we've seen. You know, that is, I mean, if we look at the stuff that we today call woke, or, you know, used to be called political correctness, all that is sort of a modern secular rendition of, you know, historic Puritan pietism, you know, and it also has this egalitarian universalist dimension, you know, and it also has elements of prophetic Judaism within it as well. So it's, like I said, it's this kind of Protestant Jewish Enlightenment hybrid that in turn is culturally dominant because of this traditional hegemonic dominance of this wider merchant commercial culture.
I see we have a caller. We didn't want to take calls earlier, may have missed one, but there's a quick request. James in Vancouver. James.
Yes, good morning. Danny, you boys speak Chinese?
I do not, no.
A little bit.
Well,
a little bit.
A little bit. Like what, ni hao?
Yeah, ni hao. So what's the question?
Yeah, well, there you go. That might do it. That'll get you for 5 minutes. All right, no further questions. Bye now.
Okay, that wasn't worth taking a call. But Travis, would you like to follow up with Keith? It was a very interesting synopsis.
No, that's very interesting. I appreciate that perspective. I didn't really link the Protestant movement to that that takeover. You know, one of the things I just find most interesting in our current times is how it is such a third rail topic. And so I've been trying to come up with different ways and methods to talk to people about it so it doesn't sound so extreme, or to get them interested and, you know, come at them from the military espionage aspect, or, you know, the monetary aspect. And you know, sometimes they're more successful than others, but it's just always been an interesting topic and thought for me, is just why is this such a taboo topic?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, go ahead. I'm done.
Patrick, please.
So Kevin McDonald had a book recently where he's talking about the deep ancestral roots of Europeans, and he has a chapter in there about America, and you've got two in the north and in the south. You had people coming from different parts of England, and if you were to trace them back, you know, some are more, go back to, say, Norman invasion, or the Anglo-Saxons, others, the Vikings. But at any rate, this Puritan elite that came from the north, that came to the north, the Puritans, who were more egalitarian, and I think Keith said that you couldn't have the Jews couldn't have penetrated to the extent that they did without that groundwork. But in the South, you had another group that was much more martial and aristocratic, that was also Protestant. So, I mean, there is a Protestant link here, but there's a lot of different versions of Protestantism. And then if you look at the United States today, if you look at the media today, I don't know how broad this is, but certainly in the media, in the Jewish-owned media, the Jews love to have Irish frontmen, you know, Irish Catholic frontmen. So, you think of Sean Hannity, who's the worst of the worst in terms of, you know, a show for the Jews. But, you know, all these people with their Irish names, whether it's O'Reilly, whether who was the guy who was for Tip O'Neill? He worked for Tip O'Neill. I just saw him on TV a couple days ago. I don't know, but all these people, if you look on MSNBC, half of their hosts have Irish names. So they certainly love that to use Irish Catholic frontmen, which offends me personally. But that's the way it is. So what about this? And E. Michael Jones will talk about a Protestant-Jewish alliance against Catholics, which I think he's really way overstating things. But in the remaining minute, do you have anything to say about that, Keith?
It's true that the Southern culture was more of a traditional European society. And in fact, in some ways, I think it was closer to some of the culture that developed in Latin America than in the Northeastern United States. But it's true that that was also Protestant, albeit a more it was less low church Protestant and it was more Anglican, at least initially, prior to the Great Awakenings. There you also had a Jewish presence, though. But you found that in Europe. I mean, you had the Spain, Portugal, some of those empires. They had their own Jewish merchant class as well. So this kind of thing that we're talking about is not exclusively Protestant, but I do think the cultural influence is that the Protestantism out is Irish culture.
Well, we'll have to continue this line of discussion another day, gentlemen. Great panel. Well, thank you, Keith, for being here as always.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Patrick. And I know there's a Boomer Vision coming up next, correct?
Oh, Boomer Vision. Yes, it's brand new Boomer Vision. Everybody will love it.
Awesome. Check it out, folks. And thank you, Travis.
Thanks, guys. Great show. Appreciate it.
Please support Republic Broadcasting. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and click on that donate page, folks, so that we will speak again soon. Transcend the construct. Regards.
Are you one of the millions of people who feel like there is a dark cloud hanging over their heads whenever they're using pharmaceutical drugs? For some, the short-term relief can turn into an opioid addiction nightmare. Have you ever wondered why CBD oil is a billion-dollar industry? It's because it works better than opioids and is actually healthy for you. However, CBD oil is stripped of all other helpful compounds found in the hemp plant. According to neuroscientists, the whole hemp plant, otherwise known as hemp paste, is even more effective than the chemically processed CBD oil. Are you ready to take back your health? You can try hemp paste for the price of a cup of coffee.
Hemppaste.com/RBN. Free shipping on orders over $50. See the banners for hemp paste at republicbroadcasting.org and visit hemppaste.com/RBN.
You can't handle the truth.
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit republicbroadcasting.org today because you can handle the truth.